introduce our speaker and say welcome to our Daily Work and Daily Lives. My name is John Beck. I co-direct not only this series, but all the other events that we do under that overall rubric. Today's talk is co-sponsored by the MSU African American and African Studies Program, the MSU Center for Gender and Global Context, and the MSU Women's Resource Center. And as I've already said, it's one of our things tied to Project 6050, and we're very proud to have that. I want to acknowledge, as I have every opportunity, the contribution of Bill and Kathy Greenwood, to a financial contribution to help keep the series going. So we're very, very happy that Bill and Kathy continue to show up when both of them are in town, and continue to believe that this is a series worth supporting. Today's talk, a lot of us have been looking forward to for a long time. This is cool. I mean, how often do you get labor, murder, all those things together in one package? And we're going to hear that story today. Because LaShawn Harris, Dr. Harris, has been a professor here at Michigan State University in the History Department since 2008. She came here from a stint at Georgia Southern University. You know, first round draft choice, she decided she wanted snow rather than, you know, the ravages of global warming in Georgia. I'm not sure what the motivation
was. I'm from
was.
New York originally.
Oh, well, that. and she finished her PhD at Howard University, an unbelievably wonderful institution. And we're very, very fired up to hear about her research. Part of this has already been published as part of a larger kind of body of work that she's doing. And so today's talk is entitled The Murder Trial of Laundress Virginia Christian, Race, Labor, and Violence as Resistance in Progressive Era Virginia. So we're looking forward to hearing this talk. So welcome, and let's give a round of welcome to LaShawn Harris.
Good afternoon. I would first like to thank Professor John Beck for inviting me to be a part of the Our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives series. And I would also like to thank AAAS, the Center for Gender and Global Context, and the Women's Resource Center for co-sponsoring this particular talk. As you know, the title of the talk is The Murder Trial of Laundress Virginia Christian, Race, Labor, and Violence as Resistance in Progressive Era Virginia. The title that you see here, I don't know if you can really see it, this is part of the larger paper article that was published in the Journal of Social History this summer, actually. This talk is part of several larger projects that I've been thinking about that examine the lives of working class black women, that explore intergender violence between women of varying race and ethnicities, that explore or interrogate the different ways in which progressive era white women use physical and lethal violence as a way to reinforce white supremacy and brutality and to control black women's bodies. And most importantly, this presentation, part of my essay again that was recently published in the Journal of Social History, is a part of a larger conversation on how black female responded to exploitive labor conditions and to days, months, and years of physical, sexual, and verbal abuse by their white employers. So I'll start. Quote, I know that I'm getting no more than I deserve. I'm prepared to answer for my sins, and I believe that the Lord has forgiven me. I fear that Mrs. Balot may not have been a Christian. I blame no one for my situation. I hope to meet Mrs. Balot in heaven. I thank all who have worked on my behalf, end quote. 17-year-old African-American Hampton, Virginia resident Virginia Christian expressed these sentiments in a handwritten note right before the Commonwealth electrocuted her on August 16, 1912. Assisted by state penitentiary officials, Christian, according to one published account, quote, calmly met her fate at 7:23 a.m., end quote. Convicted of the premeditated killing of her 51-year-old white employer, Ida Balot, on April 9, 1912, the teenager was, quote, the first of her sex to meet death in the electric chair, end quote. While Christian's murder trial and state execution stunned the American public and made national news headlines in 1912, her tragic story has largely been overlooked by historians. Contributing to the expanding historical scholarship on black women, This essay employs Christian's life as a window into the lived experiences of Southern working class African American women during the nadir. It critically outlines Christian's use of physical and lethal violence as a survival and resistance strategy against gendered violence. It also explores her murder trial and a racially diverse yet significant group of progressive era political activists' efforts to save Christian from capital punishment. On the morning of March 18, 1912, Christian went over to Balat's residence to resolve a dispute over theft. Right away, Balat accused Christian of stealing a gold locket. Although Christian denied stealing the jewelry, she alleged that Balat violently assaulted her. Startled and outraged by Balat's accusations and physical attack, a normally timid Christian stood her ground against her employer. Christian instinctually fought Balat back and, in the process of defending herself, accidentally killed her. Her response was a spontaneous yet conscious act of self-preservation and survival, and a direct challenge to race oppression, labor exploitation, and white brutality. Christian's act of self-defense, like those of many African Americans responding to white violence during the era of Jim Crow segregation, was firmly anchored in African Americans' individual and collective expressions of self-defense and protection, and paralleled that of enslaved Black men and women's wide-ranging patterns of resistance. Christian's crime breached and disrupted Southern societal norms and clearly embodied African Americans' long-standing struggle against race, class, and gender discrimination. Christopher Strand's work on African Americans' tradition of self-defense, a long-denied right, maintains that, quote, Black people defending themselves against white aggressors represented a threat to the social order. A Black person who raised his or her hand in self-protection against a white person threatened the blow not simply to an individual, but to the way things were, particularly in the South. Moreover, Christian's act of self-protection demonstrated working class Black women's impetuous ways of protecting their bodies and their often last attempts to seek and secure long-awaited personal justice, especially when legal protection seemed beyond their reach. What the American public knew about the Balat killing derived from several interviews Christian willingly gave Hampton law officials and her attorneys. According to the teenager, the physical altercation between herself and Balat erupted over theft. On March 18th, Christian arrived at Balat's house and was accused of stealing a gold locket. And this is the conversation that the women had between each other. Quote, Virgie, have you seen my locket? I can't seem to find it. No, ma'am, I ain't seen no locket. Are you sure you haven't seen it? Yes, ma'am, I ain't seen no locket. You must have it, Virgie. I ain't seen nothing of a locket. I want it back or I'll make trouble for you, Virgie, end quote. Exhibiting her presumed right to discipline her laundress, Balat, according to several published accounts and according to Christian, quote, threw a vase at the girl, hitting her on the shoulder. The vase fell and broke, and then Balat began throwing the pieces of broken vase at Virginia, end quote. Defending herself against Balat's attack, an enraged Christian, quote, grabbed a piece of the broomstick from the window, struck Balat over the forehead, and she fell instantly. Still infuriated and also to stop the woman's screams, Christian shoved the towel down her throat. She then crossed the room to get her hat, stopped to pick up Balat's pocketbook, which laid on the floor by the bureau. It contained several dollars and a ring, end quote. After the violent confrontation, Christian returned to her home, busied herself with work, telling nothing of the affair, and perhaps unaware that she had murdered her employer. William Brundage contends that, quote, labor disputes between Blacks and whites, which routinely bred frustration, suspicion, and anger on both sides of the color line, were sometimes fought out to bloody conclusions, thus weaving a thread of violence into Southern labor relations, end quote. Christian's retort to Balat's vicious attack was common among some Black laborers and illustrated many Southern Black women's impulsive and violent responses to days, months, and years of adverse working conditions. Christian was immediately accused of killing Balat. African American and white Hampton residents placed Christian at or near the scene of the crime. White Hamptonian Mrs. George Hughes, whose residence faced Balat's house, told police that, quote, she saw Virginia running into the backyard of Mrs. Balat's home, but she never knew the Negress. Her Black laundress, Lucy White, told her the woman running was Virgie Christian, end quote. 1 hour and 15 minutes after law officials discovered Balat's body, Elizabeth City County Police arrested Christian at her home, charged her with capital murder, and placed her in the city jail. While in jail, a frightened Christian confessed to the murder before she had counsel and in the presence of the county sheriff, her minister, and a local newspaper reporter. Claiming self-defense as a legal strategy was problematic for African Americans accused of committing violent crimes against whites. Rigid Southern race relations and customs dictated it was never justified for blacks to use physical force against whites. Blacks' assault on whites violated racial mores intended to subordinate blacks and represented a challenge to white supremacy. Thus, interracial homicide of whites by blacks was considered a serious offense, punishable by life imprisonment or by death. Consequently, when Christian defended herself from Balat's attack, she was unconsciously yet radically breaking from white Southern tradition and taking an enormous risk. Her individual act of self-defense endangered her life as well as the physical well-being of her family and Hampton's black community. Additionally, Christian's crime potentially fractured any interracial cooperation between Hampton middle-class blacks and whites. Regrettably for Christian, her fate, despite her admission of guilt and apparent remorse, was irreversibly doomed once she committed a crime, whether it was deliberate or accidental, against a white woman. Lasting 2 days, the state began its case against Christian on April 8, 1912, at the Elizabeth City County Circuit Court under George Clarence Robinson. Edgar Montague represented the state of Virginia, and African-American lawyers George Newsom and George Washington Fields represented the accused adolescent. The prosecutor presented several arguments that sealed Christian's fate. The Commonwealth argued that Christian was not a 16-year-old minor, but rather an adult. Proving that Christian was not an adolescent was significant to the prosecution's case, as it would demonstrate that Christian was an adult who was aware of her actions. Moreover, establishing that Christian was an adult qualified her for the death penalty and evaded a 1910 Virginia state statute that prohibited putting a juvenile to death. The prosecutor's non-adolescent theory was quickly refuted as the defendant's attorneys demonstrated that Christian was indeed a minor. Documents from the Christian Family Bible and school records dated her birth as August 15, 1895, which made Christian 16 at the time of the murder. Placing the defendant at the scene of the crime, the prosecutor maintained that Christian, quote, maliciously, willingly, and deliberately murdered her employer, end quote. The prosecutor further suggested that the Balat murder was a byproduct of a burglary gone wrong, claiming that Christian, hoping that her employer would not be home, went to the Balat home with the intentions of stealing from her employer. Charging Christian as an adult for murder, Montague and others denied her of her racial innocence as a child, as someone, according to historian Robin Bernstein, who was supposed to be naive, afraid, curious, and receive protection. Instead, the prosecution, borrowing from early 20th century popular cultural images of black women, scripted Christian as an unfeeling, violent, colored Amazon. Defending Christian was problematic for her middle-class attorneys. Her socioeconomic background and homicide charge complicated Newsom and Fields' efforts to construct respectable images of African Americans as well as maintain good interracial relations. Newsom and Fields and other bourgeois African Americans were troubled by black pathology and resented the ways in which mainstream white society used black criminality as an indictment against blackness and the entire race. Newsom and Fields faced an enormous task, defending a client that willingly confessed to committing a heinous and unforgivable crime. While both lawyers admitted that the Balat killing was violent and shocking, they argued that it was not premeditated murder and that Christian's crime was one of passion, rage, rather than malice. Christian pleaded to testify on her own behalf. However, Newsom and Fields refused to let the teenager tell exactly how the homicide occurred. According to Fields, Christian did not testify because, quote, she's a coarse-mannered, homely girl and is extremely ignorant. This may have excited bystanders and may have prompted some to try to carry out the kind of violent threats that had been made against her life, end quote. By refusing to allow Christian to testify on her own behalf, Newsom and Fields silenced and removed her agency. As many scholars have shown, testimony was significant to some African-American women's lives. Through testimony, black women candidly and courageously shared their life stories, and as recently argued by scholars Danielle McGuire and Kadada Williams, allowed many to use their voices as weapons against white supremacy and racialized sexual violence. If permitted to testify, Christian perhaps would have talked about her experiences as an exploitive worker and perhaps reminded jurors that she was a misguided teen who did not deserve to die. On April 9th, after 50 minutes of deliberation, the jury, which was an all-white jury of men, found Virginia Christian guilty of first-degree murder. Christian received the jury's verdict with indifference and exhibited considerable nervousness as Judge Robinson rendered her sentence. Quote, "It is considered by the court that the said Christian be electrocuted until she is dead within the confines of this penitentiary in this commonwealth on the 16th day of August 1912," end quote. African-American and white political activists mounted a plethora of strategies in an attempt to save Christian's life. On July 23, 1912, just a few months after Christian's conviction, the National Association of Colored Women Leaders convened at Hampton's Institute for their annual meeting, and club woman Lucy Lewis laid before the association the case of Virginia Christian. Compelled by Christian's age and her socioeconomic background, NACW members, quote, moved that a special committee be appointed to draw up a petition imploring the governor of Virginia to commute the sentence of the 17-year-old girl condemned to hang, end quote. On July 24, former NACW president Mary Church Terrell traveled to Richmond, Virginia, and presented Governor William Mann with a signed petition with the names of over 300 NACW members. The petition read, quote, "We are the members of the National Association of Colored Women, do most earnestly implore His Excellency to commute the sentence of Virginia Christian. The extreme youth of this girl, the lack of training during her childhood justifies mercy for this unfortunate girl," end quote. Likewise, the NAACP became involved in the case on August 5th, just 11 days before Christian's scheduled execution. After carefully reviewing the case's legal history and interviews, the NAACP leaders, including W.E.B. Du Bois, mobilized its Virginia staff along with other NAACP branches, and those branches were in New York, Washington, D.C., and also in Boston, around the nation, and established the Virginia Christian Litigation Fund, which helped raise money for her defense, and also they had some of their members write letters to state law officials. The Christian case even garnered support outside the Commonwealth. Members of the Allen Guard of the Bethel AME Church in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, submitted a petition to Governor Mann, begging him to spare, quote, "Miss Virginia Christian from public execution," end quote. Under the leadership of Martha Murphy, the Colored Young Women's Christian Association of Baltimore, Maryland, requested that Governor Mann, quote, "change the death penalty to that of life, of a life sentence," end quote. In Chicago, white and black residents sent over 500 letters to state officials asking mercy for the girl. The Chicago Daily World managing editor Eval Putnam noted that, quote, "Never before has there been such an impassioned appeal to save a young colored girl from being electrocuted in Virginia," end quote. Conversely, many southern whites, including Lester F. Hobbs, a Norfolk businessman and Balot's brother, agreed with the death penalty verdict. In light of the public's increasing opposition to Christian's death sentence, Hobbs appealed to Governor Mann, asking him not to interfere with the verdict. Quote, "This negress was tried by an honest Virginia jury. The court has refused to interfere with the verdict, stating that they had given her the benefit of every possible point. And I trust that after you have considered this case carefully from every viewpoint, that you will not interfere with the verdict as it stands," end quote. A Hampton Times Herald reporter commented that Christian's guilty verdict was absolutely necessary. In his estimation, African-American women, particularly household laborers, were a danger to white female employers and a threat to white domestic spaces. Quote, "Our women are largely at the mercy of their domestics, and if the law does not protect them, they are in danger every hour," end quote. After carefully looking into the case, Governor Mann did not feel justified in interfering with the judgment of the court and jury and did not commute Christian's sentence to life imprisonment. On August 16th, just 5 months after the murder and one day after her 17th birthday, the state of Virginia executed Virginia Christian at the state penitentiary in Richmond. The Richmond Virginian reported that, quote, the 17-year-old Negro murderess emerged from her cell, took her place between two prison guards, and walked calmly to the little death chamber in the Virginia penitentiary. She refrained from giving out any statements. She had confessed her guilt and claimed that she had made her peace with God, end quote. The Virginia Christian case was one of the most troubling and publicized legal cases of 1912. Widely covered by African American and white newspapers around the nation, the case underscored the tumultuous relationships between African American laborers and her white employers, and the various ways in which some Southern African American women responded to racial violence. The broader implications of the Christian case exposed racial disparities within the Commonwealth of Virginia's criminal justice system and the absence of a reformatory for black female juvenile offenders in the state of Virginia. The controversial case became one of the many catalysts for the 1915 formation of the Virginia Industrial School for Colored Girls, the Commonwealth of Virginia's first and only juvenile reformatory for African American girls. Established and financed and supported by prominent black and white Virginia political activists, most notably Hampton Club woman Janie Porter Barnett, the school proposed to transform African American girls labeled as wayward into models of domesticity and respectability. Moreover, school founder Porter hoped to rescue some of the state's most troubled black female juveniles from unfair prison terms and from falling victim to Virginia Christian's horrific quandary. Thank you.
What a case. Well, I'm sure I've got lots of questions. I'm sure other people do too. So let me open it up. And if you would, LaShawn, please repeat the question, just because you and I are the only two mic'd, before you answer it. So questions or comments so far? I guess let me ask a question, because you're really raising this as a, was violence by black workers regarded as, was it so common that Virginia Christian is simply confirming the case as far as a lot of these Virginians are concerned? Or is she such an outlier that that she really stands out as an outlier? How much was violence resistance, as in the title of your talk?
I think that violence is extremely prevalent within for working class blacks on a daily basis, and I think that violence could be as simple as, or even not physical violence, but even verbal violence, verbal harassment, is prevalent for some African Americans. And I think for Christian, at least, this was something I don't think that she expected to do on the day that she went to Balot's house. Balot was known within the community to have a bad temperament. Virginia Christian's family members had worked for Balot, so they knew that this woman had a reputation for harassing blacks, for cheating blacks out of pay. And Virginia Christian knew that she was a breadwinner for her family. Her mother was paralyzed and could not work. Her father was the sole breadwinner. He was a laborer, and he was also a fisherman. So they needed that income. And I suspect that Virginia Christian, like many Southern blacks, did not leave that job because she needed the money, or she was looking for, and at the time before the murder, she was looking for other avenues of income. But I found other cases where violence becomes a major factor as a way to resist the days and the months and years of oppression for black people. There was a case in 1892 in South Carolina, a 14-year-old girl by the name of Milby Brown, who, and again, I don't know the full context, but she went into work. She was, her work was lethargic according to her employer. She got upset, didn't appreciate her employer's comments, went to the back room and poisoned the woman's baby and killed her, right? So this may have been an isolated incident for Brown, but this is not to say that she didn't endure days and months of of physical abuse. At the same time, I think that black laborers understand that their actions have consequences, right? So if they're not, you know, participating in any type of physical violence against their employers, they may be verbally, you know, challenging them, or they may be very similar to the enslaved population, you know, working slow or pretending not to know how to do something, right? So the resistance may be seen as, I don't want to say, well, for the sake of the argument, passive in a way. But I think in this particular case in Hampton, this was rare for a 13-year-old girl to kill her employer, because there was a lot at stake. I mean, again, I think I pointed this out in the paper. Anything could have happened to her family or the larger African-American community as a whole, even if they had, you know, said, we understand why you did this. Actually, the black community, at least the middle-class blacks, did not support Virginia Christian. They actually felt sorrow and grief for Balot and her family. And again, this may have been an outward thing to protect the black community. So violence is a major factor for blacks. I'd like to just to kind of go off just a little bit. I was attracted to this case because it shows white women and their role in Southern, and their role in violence. Oftentimes when we think about laborers, black women, black men, we tend to think about, you know, white men as the aggressors. In this case and other cases that I've found where black women have been harassed, beaten, or even murdered, these cases involve white women, right? So I thought it was important to bring out some different gender dynamics as we talk about, you know, violence within the context of labor.
So just to follow up, LaShawn, so what you're saying is that you think that there might have been a class solidarity between black and white upper class or middle class women?
At least outwardly, right?
And you think that it might have been strategic.
It could have been. I mean, there are blacks who are, you know, they subscribe to the ideals, you know, they assimilate into white culture. This is the era of Jim Crow segregation, so I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt and say that we want to save face, we want to maintain good working relationships with white liberals, so we are going to condemn Christian and her family and support this other family whose mother, she was a mother of eight, who was murdered. And again, they could have genuinely felt sorry for Balot and her family, or this could have been, you know, an outward gesture to save faith for the black community and also to protect the African American community, because anything could have happened. We all know that some of these things, you know, lead to race riots. Mm-hmm. You know, when other blacks come to other blacks' defense, you know, that leads to racial violence in many different cities.
Other questions or comments over here?
Thank you for your talk. You have so many questions. I noticed in your talk sometimes you use the word unconsciously she's challenged the racial order, and then you also said consciously. So maybe you could talk a little bit about how far you can establish from the sources that are there, given that as so often women don't leave many written sources, African-American women leave even fewer written sources. In that moment, did Virginia herself simply she just defended herself, she's attacked, like you just have a fight or flight response, and you don't think about the racial order. And it's others then who say, well, this is a conscious attack.
Yeah.
Given, however, that, you know, violence is maybe not the best strategy, given the pervasiveness of Jim Crow. I mean, it doesn't really help to stand up when you're getting executed, or the police will go after you, or you get lynched, and so on and so forth. I mean, could you talk about what we know about her, what she thought at the moment, and how she interpreted it later?
The sources don't, you know, obviously don't, I speculate. I mean, the sources don't let me know what her intentions were necessarily. In that moment, Christian was being attacked, and she was defending herself. It was an instinct to protect herself and to protect her body, again, which is something that is denied of, you know, black female laborers. At the same time, and again, this is all, I don't know for sure. I mean, I don't know if this was a pattern that Christian had experienced violence at the hands of Balaad. It is known throughout the town that this woman was, you know, difficult, that she cheated people out of money. There was one rumor that she actually beat one of her employers. The Christian family had worked for that, for her family, her mother and her dad had worked for Balaad. But no, this is, you know, I can't say for sure if she consciously was aware of what she was doing. I mean, she was protecting herself. Obviously, after she committed the murder, or she physically attacked Balaad, she was fully aware of what she had done. But no, I mean, this was just instinctual for her. But just putting a little bit of analysis on this, this can be seen as a conscious act of resistance, in that Christian is defending herself. But no, the sources don't speak to the fact that she said, I'm gonna
kill.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I saw other hands. Yes, Dorothy.
What was the gender-based makeup of the jury at that time, and what is it like in that state today?
I don't know. Oh, okay, go ahead. I don't know what the dynamics of the present day, the gender dynamics of the county today? Is that what you were asking, the gender dynamics of the county?
Well, what was the jury like in terms of those two qualities?
Well, for her particular case, it was an all-white male jury. And again, this is not to suggest that blacks didn't serve on juries. In this particular county, as far as I'm aware of, I didn't see any records that suggested that blacks had served on the jury for a whole host of reasons. I mean, blacks were disenfranchised, just generally speaking, in the South on various, you know, extra legal requirements and stuff. But blacks hadn't been serving on juries in Hampton. So it was pretty routine that it was not unusual for her to be tried or convicted by men that were not her peers. In terms of the makeup of jury pools today in Hampton, I have no idea what that looks like. I'm assuming, and I would hope, that the jury pool would be more diverse compared to 1912. Today? They might. I think it depends on the case. It depends on the circumstances of the case. It depends on the activism of local groups within a particular city. You know, I don't know if larger groups such as the NAACP or the National Urban League, how they select cases, but I think it depends largely on the black activism within a certain city or community. They may come to defendants' cases. And again, we don't hear about those small grassroots types of organizations because, you know, they don't have these big time public intellectuals or activists within their group. So I think it depends on the case. Yes, because the last woman. Virginia Christian was the last woman to be executed in 1912. The next woman to be executed was in 2010. Her name was Teresa Lewis, and she was executed for plotting to kill her husband. So, yeah, that was the last that I know of. May have been one before, after 2010, but Teresa Lewis, I believe, was the last one.
Other questions? Well, let me ask one, and then we'll go back. Help me understand, I guess, that the thing that sticks out about this, for any of us who like watched too many law programs on TV or whatever, is that she's obviously not involved in first degree murder, because this is a crime of passion. This is second degree murder, if even that. I mean, I think that, but they convicted her of premeditated murder. So they're arguing that she went to the house. I guess they're arguing that she went there and it was a failed robbery. Therefore, that's what makes it first degree murder, correct? Is that the notion of the charge? I mean, it's amazing that they would, that this legal case spun out of control like that, because of the fact that obviously her defense attorney wasn't, because you would have to prove that indeed she was coming there with the intent of stealing or whatever.
But not that uncommon during that time, right? Because African Americans, particularly household workers, the belief is that, again, they are a danger to white domestic spaces, and that they have a proclivity to theft, and they're already seen as violent and lawless people, right? So for them to script her as an adult who went in to rob her, and Virginia Christian didn't do herself any favors by even taking the purse. Right. She took the purse, and when they went to her house, they found this purse. So that was damaging for her. But the fact that she was charged as an adult, and the fact that they saw this as a burglary gone wrong, is not that uncommon, because we know that with household workers, anything that goes missing in the house, even if it's misplaced by the employer, you are going to be accused of stealing, whether you took it or not. And then, you know, again, she didn't do herself any favors. They found like a blood, and I didn't, this is all in the article. They found the bloody rag in her house. They found the jewelry in the house. They found some money in the house, a few dollars that she had taken. And then people had saw her at the scene. I think I just gave you one account, but there were blacks and whites who testified that they saw her leaving this particular house, despite the fact that they knew that, again, Balot was a really crappy employer. And I'm not saying that she deserved to die, but she was a crappy employer.
but I mean, it's three or four wrongs don't make a right. Yeah. In this case, it was wrong that she was tried as an adult. It's wrong, perhaps, that that they were thinking of it in terms of premeditated murder, unless they were making the argument that exactly that you're saying that they made, which is really about it as a failed burglary rather than any other reason. That if she came there, she didn't come with the idea of murdering, perhaps, but she murdered with something that was premeditation, because she was there to steal, you know, and on and on and on in that way. You had another question.
Yeah. Can you put this case into a larger context of women's history in the South? I mean, the question how much of the violence against slaves was committed by the women on the plantations, and so a lot of research says, well, there was the sexual threat, so that a lot of white women struck out against the women who they saw as sexual competitors. I mean, the case might be of Celia Slave, of course. Slavery, so now we are, of course, we have Jim Crow, but I was wondering, in this household, were they men? Would that have played any role, this idea that you have to, the employer, I forgot her name, I'm sorry, that she wanted to protect white men from a sexually alluring white woman?
No, I don't think so. I mean, in this particular case, she had 8 children. She was a widow. Her husband had died in 1911 of cancer. She was the breadwinner. She was the head of her house. And, you know, like many women throughout the enslavement period and even during the Progressive Era, and there's a great book by Thenobia Glenn called Out of the House of Bondage, which talks about white women and violence from the era of slavery up into the Progressive Era, that white women, as the mistresses of their domestic spaces, need those spaces to be protected. And part of protecting themselves, their families, and those spaces is reinforcing white supremacy on the people that are the closest to them. And those people that are closest to them happen to be the black laborers. So I think that violence, and I know that the scholarship doesn't really talk about white women and violence as much, but there are plenty of cases where you see white women like decapitating black women. I found a case in Decatur, Georgia in the 1930s where a white woman, her name is Bertha Smith, it wasn't over labor. I mean, she did work for her, but it wasn't over labor. she decapitated her over something you just said. Smith was married. She was having an affair with another man. Her laundress or maid, Clara Wallace, was having an affair with the same lover and got pregnant and didn't like that. And she came to work and she beat her and she beheaded her. So violence becomes a big thing for these women. So I think it's about protecting their own authority, because sometimes when, even with Christian going back and forth with her saying, I didn't have it, you know, Balat was, I believe, was struck by her talking back to her, right? So oftentimes when you have, you know, sassy or, you know, back-talking laborers, you have to control them, right? So I think that, you know, in many cases, they may be, you know, the violence may come out of protecting their own home and not letting women, you know, invade their sexual spaces with their husbands. But some of this also is challenging their own authority. And we know that for white women, a lot of that authority that's in the house, for them is really important, especially when they don't have authority in the public sphere, right? So the private sphere for them, I'm thinking this out as I'm trying to respond. So for them, the private sphere and control becomes important to them.
But isn't it also the case, I guess, that it's always been the province, if you go back in master-servant law, not only in terms of slave and master relationships, mm-hmm. but even master-servant relationships, whether it be indentured servants or otherwise, where masters have normally been given a huge amount of latitude legally to be able to in effect, beat mm-hmm. servants and discipline servants. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe it is, by extension, the power of the home, you know, or that space. But I think that it's even tradition, if you go back in English law and everything else, I mean, it's a very, very strong kind of relationship that the master of a home, in this case, the female mistress of the home, has a huge mm-hmm. power traditionally and legally over those people who work for them in the home. More so than you would, I think, maybe than outside of the home and other kind of workplaces. Mm-hmm. Other questions? Yes, Bert.
How did you research this? Is there a book out, or did you just read
I was working on my first, my book, which is on black female labor in New York City during the early 20th century. I look at informal economies, so prostitution, numbers runners, anything that's informal, underground. And a lot of my source base is, you know, a whole bunch of different types of records, but newspapers is key to my source background. And I was looking for stuff on New York, and I found this particular case, and I looked at it, and I said, this looks interesting. I'll just put it aside and, you know, won't think about it, because I'm not thinking about Virginia. I'm thinking about New York. And the case kept popping up, like I kept seeing it. So I printed the case out and I brought the newspaper article to my class and I just showed it to them. And they kept asking me questions about Virginia Christian, like what happened to her, how did this happen? And I just said, I don't know, you know, I don't know. So I decided to just, you know, perhaps do some research. And luckily for me, most of the case file is at the Library of Virginia in Richmond, Virginia. And I went to undergrad college in Richmond, Virginia. So I was able to go to the library and see friends and stuff. But it came out of this newspaper that just kept popping up. And then I found a whole bunch of newspapers nationwide on the case. And that led me to the NAACP papers, the National Association of Colored Women papers, and also, what else did I look at? The Elizabeth City State and County Court records. The prison files. This sounds like a lot, but it's not a lot. So that's how I came upon the case. I just happened to find it.
Now, I guess another burning question for all of us might be, how come there wasn't an appeal? That is, did the NAACP or any of the other people that were agitating on her behalf, did they ever think that maybe the case should actually be appealed?
I think in the case file, it doesn't really talk much about an appeal. I mean, the only thing that I gleaned was this computation for death to commune the sentence, but there was no appeal. I'm not sure exactly why there wasn't an appeal. I don't know if money was an issue, but I don't know, to be honest with you, why they didn't try to appeal the case.
Okay. Other questions or comments? Yes, Chris.
Can you say any more about how the opposition to her hanging was organized in Chicago? You said it was
very high. Yeah, and again, this is all from newspaper articles that I had gathered. Because the NAACP had mobilized, and the NAACP was formed in 1909, only had three branches. But they had, you know, they had supporters around the nation, both black and white. So I suspect that with the NAACP, the National Association of Colored Women, the Chicago Defender reported on this case, that many, you know, blacks and liberal whites were drawn to the case because of Christian's age. And I don't bring this out in this paper, but I bring it out in the essay. Because Virginia Christian was believed to be feeble-minded. So many people came to her defense because she was 16 and because she was feeble-minded and she came from a poor background where the paper just, you know, went to town on the family, how poor they were, how her mother was crazy. So I think that's why they were somewhat attracted to the case. But yeah, at least according to some of my newspaper accounts, at least 500 different blacks and whites came to her defense and wrote letters to the governor asking them to change her, to commute her sentence to life imprisonment.
And I can't help but look at the visual evidence. Did you quote someone saying that she was homely?
Yes, that's what the attorney said. The way she was scripted in so many different ways. So while you have the prosecution scripting her as this, again, violent, lawless, colored Amazon, you have her black supporters and defendant. And again, this is a strategy that they use to get her off. They paint her as this, again, illiterate. And she went to school up until she was about 12 or 13, but as this illiterate, poor girl. Her mother doesn't work. She comes from a poor family. They didn't raise her properly. She's wayward, so we feel sorry for her. But Christian was she was nothing like that. She was someone who was hardworking. Her mother was sick. She was raised to support her family economically, which meant leaving school on account of her family. So she was scripted in so many different ways by the prosecution, by people who were defending her, and also by black opposition within Hampton, because they really went to town on her to show that they were in support of, at least outwardly, in support of Balot and their family.
Great. Well, any last questions? Thank you so much for a fascinating talk. Do sign in if you haven't signed in. Look forward to seeing you all, and let's at Michael Honey next Thursday, and let us give LaShawn Harris another wonderful round of applause.
Thank you.